Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mays, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Phil Rowley, and he'll be answering your most important questions on advanced chronometer techniques. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Phil Rowley about advanced chronometer techniques. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to the website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. Well, before we introduce Phil, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Phil's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Phil and Brian Chan's latest DVD, Conquering Chronometers, Volume 1 Strike Indicator Techniques, as well as Phil's book, Stillwater Selections, and the DVD, Learning with the Pros, a perfect companion to the book. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, type fast, and hopefully you'll win a DVD or a book and DVD, courtesy of Phil Rowley. Well, tonight our guest is Phil Rowley, and at the age of 6, Phil was introduced to the coarse fishing in England and has been hooked ever since. For over 20 years, Phil has been fly fishing still waters almost exclusively. His love of stillwater fly fishing has taken him all over British Columbia and Washington in the pursuit of trout and char. A former commercial fly tier, Phil has written for almost every major fly fishing publication in North America. Phil's book, Fly Patterns for Still Waters, is a bestseller. As a complement to Fly Patterns for Still Waters, Phil's released his latest book, Stillwater Selections. Phil has a number of tying DVDs, including Tying Flies for Stillwaters, Tying and Fishing Stillwater Flies, and Learning with the Pros, Stillwater Fly Tying Volume 1, with longtime friend Brian Chan. Phil and Brian have also recently released the first in a three-part DVD series detailing how to fish chronometers, entitled Conquering Chronometers Volume 1. When he is not tying flies or on the water, Phil travels western North America, performing at outdoor shows, teaching at a variety of seminars, speaking to fly clubs, and conducting weekend fly fishing schools. In addition to Phil's shows and seminars, he's also had a good fortune to appear on such TV shows as Sport Fishing BC, Fishing Alberta, The New Fly Fisher, and Fishing with Shelley and Courtney. Recently, Phil became one of the co-hosts for The New Fly Fisher, a television production dedicated to fly fisher education. Phil's website at www.flycraftangling.com is dedicated to fly fishing and fly tying education, featuring tips, techniques, and streaming video. This comprehensive site is constantly changing to meet the needs of its members. Well, Phil, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. It's great to be back.
Yeah, good to have you again. And Phil is telling we were talking about the weather, as we all do all the time, and you're about ready to break ice up there, aren't you?
Well, not quite yet. But
no?
I'm cautiously hoping for the temperatures to drop so we can get into the fall fishing season and get those fish, get the feed bags on and get after them in the shallows.
Yeah, yeah. So, winter's coming and be here quick enough. Too quickly, I guess, for most people. But,
yeah, and too long for me.
And too long, yeah. Yeah, I remember I grew up for a while in Anchorage, Alaska, and I just remember walking to school in the dark and walking home in the dark. And it was a lot of board games were played back then. That's what happened. But anyway, let's get into it here. We've got a bunch of good questions, and I know let's just start it off with a few kind of get us oriented questions, and then we'll dig into some of the techniques that you promised us, and then we'll take some questions from our audience. So, one of the questions that came in is, are midges and chironomids the same?
Yes, midges, chironomids, or as the English refer to them as buzzards. They're all one and the same bug. Yeah.
But we do talk differently about them when we're doing still water versus moving water, right?
Yeah, we tend to, in my point of reference, midges are referred to as moving water because so many of the species that inhabit moving waters are just so tiny, and hence the midge name that they've been provided. But in still waters, we get spoiled a little bit. We get our, in some waters I fish, such as when I lived in British Columbia, we still got them in Alberta here. We get them called bombers, where they're 5/8 of an inch or long or greater. Where you're fishing size 6 scud hooks and wishing they made a size 4.
Yeah. The Otim in La Grande, Oregon, wrote in and he says, there are several thousand species of chironomids in the U.S. and Canada, yet in all the fly fishing literature, a midge is a midge is a midge. Has anyone subdivided this huge family of insects into smaller groups by behavior or ecological niche like we've done with the mayflies, stoneflies, caddisflies?
Not that I'm aware of, and it's possibly because everybody seems to like mayflies, stoneflies, or caddisflies, but not everybody likes midges, so I don't think they're as popular necessarily, but thankfully we don't necessarily need to get to know them at that level. We just know, recognizing their key features and their emergence habits, and then we can match our flies and presentation to be successful with them.
Yeah, I like tying them because they're so easy to tie.
Exactly. Yeah, if you're taking more than about 2 or 3 minutes, you're probably getting a bit too complex.
Yeah, in an afternoon you can fill a couple of boxes up easily, and you feel really accomplished. And then you go tie an adult mayfly and it slows you down a bit,
Yeah. Or a big dragonfly nymph or a stonefly nymph.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk. You posed to us 3 different methods of fishing chironomids, and let's start out with the first one and maybe give us a little background about how these relate to the way most people might be fishing midges now. But our first question is, what is the deep water indicator fishing and how is that done? So,
yeah, like you say, it's probably a good idea to sort of back up and just review a little bit. The most common method today that I see and is to suspend chironomid larva or pupa patterns under a strike indicator, and generally working shallower waters, and it's a very productive method. It works very well, but when I learned how to fish chironomids, strike indicators weren't around, so we used different techniques. We used the dry line long leader technique that we'll talk about, that we refer to as naked. We've got some unique names for some of these things, and just the evolution. So today's modern fly fisher uses a lot of standard indicator techniques. That's what I see across Western Canada and Western United States when I travel and fish. And it's just, I worry sometimes that people think that's the only way to fish chironomids and maybe a little critical because just staring at a quote-unquote bobber is the only way to do it. And it's definitely effective. But there's some more methods that maybe take a little more finesse and a little more practice to getting to know. But they all have, like every method, they all have their sweet spot and they can be very, very effective.
Yeah, it's always good to have another tool in your toolbox, right?
I look at fly fishing a bit like golf. You've got a bag of clubs, and each one has a purpose and a use, and you You know, to be a good golfer, which I'm not, you need to, you know, get to know each club, its strengths, its weaknesses, and what situations it should be used in. And a lot of the methods we use in stillwater fly fishing, and particularly coronamid fishing, sort of fall into that niche as well, about learning each method, becoming proficient with it, and knowing when's the best times to use it so you can have the best chance of success when you're on the water.
Before we jump into these techniques, a question just came to my mind is, how do you know if a lake is got coronamids in it, if it's worth fishing in that fashion? Is that something you can test for?
Well, they're a pretty widespread and diverse group. To be honest, I can't think of a lake I fished I haven't run into them. And, you know, there's obviously different densities, but, you know, your best coronamid waters, you know, tend to the most part to have rich, muddy bottoms. They prefer that habitat. The larva or the bloodworm love to establish themselves in there. But they can live in a whole host of different waters, from brackish ponds to lakes to sloughs to you name it. They live everywhere. So I'd be hard-pressed to imagine a lake that doesn't have some population of coronamids in them. But by far in western North America, they seem to have the most dense, the densest populations. And that is such why it's such a critical food source to get to know, because if you want to be successful in lakes, sooner or later you got to come to terms with these little skinny bugs and figure out how to fish with them, because it's the way to have really good stillwater success.
Okay. So let's come back to my question. What is deep water indicator fishing, and how is it?
Well, the deep water technique is the challenge with deep water indicator fishing. With the, you know, a lot of people use the quick release indicators that I guess you could say I popularized over the year, but around. And these are indicators that one of the drawbacks of using traditional corky style or yarn indicators is that once you put them in place, they don't move. So these quick release indicators, once the you know, the strike is recognized, you're setting the hook, and the fish's reaction to that disengages a loop that is in the leader that's pinched between the indicator peg and the indicator itself. So it releases and it slides up and down the leader and doesn't become a barrier to landing the fish. But when you start fishing deeper water, and I'm talking 15 and probably even more realistically 18, 19, 20 feet, when you build a long leader and use these quick release indicators, you know, sometimes they don't release very well, and it's not really the fault of the indicator at all. It's the, over that length of nylon and fluorocarbon, there's such stretch in there that that striking motion is kind of absorbed and the indicator won't release. So you can still fish effectively with a nylon fluorocarbon type leader setup, but you have problems with the leader releasing. So I sort of first ran into this method a few years ago, and this past spring I had the good fortune to fish, or early summer rather, to fish Crowley Lake down in California. And that's sort of in a stillwater fishery that's on my bucket list to do. And I had the good fortune to fish with a local guide down there by the name of Ernie Gully. And he sort of used this method all the time. And it's a total breakaway. It's a different leader construction. And what we use is we use 10 feet of braided line, like, you know, the braided lines that are so popular in conventional fishing nowadays. And we're using probably anywhere from 15 to 20-pound test. Line, very thin, very strong, and no stretch. So we're using, you can either clinch knot this to the welded loop, or I prefer just a loop-to-loop connection. You put your quick-release indicator on. At the end of that 10-foot length, you can use a split ring, or I often use a small barrel swivel, like size 12, 14, or 16, and then you add your fluorocarbon tippet. And what you end up with is a leader system that you adjust the fluorocarbon to match the total depth that you need, because typically you want to start suspending your flies depending on the bottom makeup. If it's a muddy bottom, I like to be about a foot off the bottom. If it's weeds, I'll probably be a foot or so off the tops of the weeds where the fish are grazing on the coronamids. And you want to keep, that's where you adjust the length. So you want to have about 10 feet of this braided leader. And the beauty of this is when that indicator is take, you know, when you recognize a take on the indicator, I think you get a much more sensitive connection because of the no stretch in that braided leader, and it releases like the dickens. You just raise and set, and that indicator pops. There's no stretch. There's no delay. It releases right away. So you can now effectively fish strike indicators, you know, in 18, 19 feet. When I was down there in the early summer this year, we were doing just that. We were fishing 19, 20 feet down, you know, with size 16, 14, very, very skinny coronamid patterns. Crowley Lake gets a lot of pressure, so those fish really like their flies skinny and realistic, and it made all the difference in the world.
Now, when you're doing this deep water indicator fishing. How do you judge the depth? How do you leader lengths and setups for different
What we're doing is a couple of key tools. These are the methods I'm going to talk to about tonight are all from an anchored position, so we have total line control. And when we're fishing in boats, that's double anchored, typically an anchor system at the bow, an anchor system at the stern, so there's no sway because the takes can be subtle. And if you're sitting there in a watercraft that's constantly swaying back and forth, you're going to miss, you know, not be able to react or totally miss strikes, particularly when we talk about the naked technique in a few minutes where there is no indicator. So that's there. We make use of electronics. Years ago, we used to use marked anchor ropes, meaning we paint a mark on our anchor rope every 5 feet and simply count the number of marks that go into the water, and you could get a gauge of the depth. Nowadays, we use sounders, and we know exactly what we're sitting in. So you have an approximate idea. Let's say I've pulled up. We have, chronomids are emerging around you, or there's chronomid activity. You're seeing adults on the surface, or the pupil shucks, the clear shucks with the little white tufts of gills on the surface. That's what we ran into at Crowley. You know, we were on the water at 7 a.m., which is early by my standards, but standard down there, so locals know best. And we set up, and they were emerging already. It was a muddy bottom. You could see that by, you know, interpreting what the sounder is telling you. No signs of much in the way of weed, so we were in approximately 20 feet. But you want to make sure we started with our flies about a foot off the bottom, because when the hatches are intense, the fish can really zone in and only feed in a very narrow band. It could be a 6-inch band, a 12-inch band, so you want to make sure your fly's in there, and it takes experimentation. And what I advocate, Brian as well, I know you did a chronomid interview with him a while back, is start at the bottom and kind of work your way up. That's where, you know, the pupil will stage just above the bottom for, you know, when I was doing some of the research for my first book, I had an aquarium set up, and I would watch pupa take up to 4 days to elevate from just above the bottom of the aquarium up to the surface before they started to hatch. So they're gathering there. The trout are just basically swimming through, picking them off easily, almost grazing on them. There's so many of them. So we start with them off a foot off the bottom. So what we do to really set our weight is we'll set our depth, rather, is we know we're in 20 feet, so we'll maybe have a ruler mounted in the boat or use an arm length or some measure you're comfortable with that's reasonably accurate. So I'm in that 20 feet. I want to set my setup for 19 feet. So I would have that 10 foot of braided leader on, and then my swivel or my split ring, and then I might add another 10 feet of fluorocarbon tippet. All right.
When
so
you say braided, are you talking like
Fireline? Yeah, Fireline. Power Pro, those kind of leaders. You want to get one that has a smooth coating on it. Some of them are, you know, you got to check them out a bit. You got to venture over into the dark side. I always tease people going over into the non-fly fishing part of the store. There's lots of good goodies over there for the fly fisher. And, you know, select one. They come on big spools, you know, and they can range in price. It can be from, I don't know, $15, a 200 or 150-yard spool or whatever, up to $30. And the thicker ones I like a little bit better. They're just a little more stiffer, if you will, so they'll turn over. Because the one drawback to this method is because you're basically using a level leader setup, if your casting is a little suspect or you're a little lazy, you can get some pretty horrendous tangles at times because the leader system, the indicator, multiple flies, it's just like a bolo. It lassoes around. So nice open casting loops. We're not making long-distance casts here. So, again, I've got that braided leader, 10 feet of it, to my swivel and split ring. And in that 20-foot, 19-foot scenario, I may have another 10 feet of fluorocarbon. So I've got enough to reach the surface to the bottom. And then I set my indicator to what I believe to be 19 feet. Once I've got that set up, and you can see this, I'll refer to this a couple of times in our new Chronoma DVD because we show how to do this on there, you attach a weight to your fly. It can be a pair of hemostats. We use a lot of times, because we're up in the frozen north here, for ice fishing, they're called depth locators, I think they're called. They're a little weight, a lead weight with an alligator clip on them. Come in all kinds of hot fluorescent colors that the ice fishermen use because they set their presentations up almost the same way. So we attach this weight. That pulls the indicator under the water, and it will pull the indicator under the water until it hits the bottom. So you just lower it over the side of the boat, it'll go down, and you'll see your indicator underneath the surface of the water. And the distance between the surface of the water and the indicator translates to, when you take that weight off, how much your fly is going to be hanging off the bottom.
Right.
Hopefully that makes
sense.
Gotcha. So now you've you know, in a surgical kind of way, you approximately set the depth, but if the fish are really super selective on depth, only cruising in that set band, now you know for sure exactly what it's set at, and then you start from there. And then you might fish for a little while there, and then this is where the, again, the no exact science comes in, because sometimes it just, there is a level of gut feel and experience to all these things. If you believe this fish in the area, you know, you're fishing with a partner and they're catching fish and you're not, so you could be at the wrong depth. You could have too big a fly, too fat a fly. Color can come into it. You know, there's variables in there. So you're constantly experimenting if you're not getting the, you know, what you think you should be getting. Right.
Right.
So that makes all sense. It's
good, good. We need to take a quick break, but
sure.
When we come back, we'll continue this conversation about the deep water indicator fishing for trout. So hang with us, folks. We'll be right back. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads stillwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Phil Rowley about advanced chronomid techniques. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Phil, I always ask my guests at this point in the show what's going on in your fly fishing world, and I know you're a busy man, so tell us what's happening.
Well, in the immediate future, this time next week, I'll be in southwest Manitoba, province just north of North Dakota. And right now, that's a favorite haunt of mine because it's just got some incredible stillwater trout fishing. And for about the last 4.5 years, I have been taking groups of anglers out there from all over North America to experience this fishing for itself. So I'll be taking a group out there for a week of fishing. We provide food, accommodation. I give seminars every day, and everybody gets cycled through my boat for at least a day, or at least as long as they can stand me beside them, and then do that. And then, of course, in the new year, the show season gets off and running right away in January. I'll be at the fly fishing shows in Denver, the Boise Valley Fly Fishing Show the following weekend, and obviously Boise. I'll be in Linwood, Washington again this year, Pleasanton, California, speaking there. Obviously, Brian and I have started our new online Stillwater Fly Shop. We opened that in June of last year, and that's going great guns. People can get our books and DVDs and our, you know, have access to our Stillwater flies, basically the flies you'd find in our fly box. That's what we have there. I'm working on a new book. I have been for about the last year and a half, so I need to, over the cold winter months, put my nose to the grindstone and get some work accomplished on that. In the new year, Brian will be working on volume two of the DVD, The Advanced Techniques, this one will be called. So a lot of what we're talking tonight will be covered in in-depth detail on that DVD. Got my own YouTube channel now, so you can watch me tie flies as well, many of my favorite stillwater flies and other patterns that I like to do. Lots going on.
Well, lots, I'd say. Like I said, you're a busy man. Well, it sounds like you're having some fun, too, with all that. So that's
you have to have fun.
Important part there. But good. Well, we did get a question here. Internet. Let's see. When you fish with an indicator, is it crucial to keep it as still as possible, or can you move it?
No. Actually, there's four sort of ways that we use the indicator. There's, and a lot of it is experimentation. You know, the pitch it out and stare at it till you go crazy, the static method is probably the one most people use. I tend to use the static method when fish are, you know, it's really cold water conditions, so their metabolism's low, they're not as apt to run around and chase a fly or move very far, or when you've got a weather system that's come in and put them off, they tend to like their food not moving. And, of course, this method we talk about, we also use indicators to hang a whole host of flies nowadays, and probably the next most popular one after chronomids are leech patterns and balance leeches in particular. These are leeches that are configured using a jig hook and a tungsten bead and a pin. If you go to my YouTube site, you can see how it all goes. but the fly hangs horizontally and moves in a manner similar to the leeches. So we're using other flies for this as well. So we fish those. That's static situations. If I'm not sure of what the mood the fish is in, I'll often cast. I'll let it sit static. And if nothing happens, then I'll start a slow hand twist retrieve. Or I'll even integrate that if there's a bit of a breeze. We will, you know, we're anchored with the wind at our back. I'll make a quartering cast to your left or right, whichever is most comfortable to cast to, on about a 30-degree angle. And you're just going to let that line swing and sweep all the way down until it hangs below you, and then you start a slow hand twist and bring it all the way back in before you cast again. And the beauty of this method, in algae I use, if there's a 10-foot circle of visibility, we'll call it, around your fly, and you just pitch it out there and let it sit static, a fish has to come into that circle to find your fly. But if you can make that circle move, so if you wind drift down 50 feet, and then come back up with a slow hand twist another 50 feet, you've covered 100 times 10. That's like 1,000 feet if my math is up to par. And that's simply you're covering more water with a static or near-static presentation. So that's kind of what I use when I'm exploring. I'm not sure what the fish will want. If the fish are active, calm days, this method works well, is every once in a while you'll give a long, slow 6 to 12-inch pull. So you literally pull the indicator across the water, almost drag it across the surface. It's not like trying to pop a bass popper or something like that. It's just a long, slow pull. What that's going to do is pull on the fly. It'll flutter up, and then you stop, and then it just sinks back down again. And that motion, you know, trout being primarily sight feeders, in a sea of other chironomids, yours suddenly stands up and moves up. It draws attention. Fish will come over. So quite often with that method, you draw the fly, and as soon after you stop, you quite often get quite a confident take. It'll pull right under. And then the other method we use this with chironomids, but it also really works well with leech patterns. And Brian uses this a lot with leech patterns, is to cast them. If the wind is not too strong, is to cast them upwind and simply let the wind push the indicator and fly line back towards you. It's like upstream nymphing, and you're just gathering line, staying in contact with everything, and covering water that way. So those are kind of the four methods I use. So it's not just a pitch it out and stare at it and hope for something to happen. I always say, if people are getting bored with indicator fishing, do something. Move the fly, stay engaged, because as soon as you start to wander, you know, that's when a trout will show up, and you'll miss it.
When you said use a sounder to get the depth of the water, you're talking about a weight on a...
No, I'm using the electronics.
Oh, okay.
Fish line. I call them sounders because, you know, in the shallow waters we fish, a lot of times the cone hitting the bottom doesn't so much, you know, if it runs over a fish, and this, depending on how your sounder is configured and how you set it up, you know, whether it actually sees a fish can be a bit suspect. I'm sure, hopefully there's not anybody from the electronics industry listening to me, but it's just my experience. Of course, in deeper water, the sounder, I start to believe it a lot more because the cone of vision the transducer puts out simply maps more of the bottom, and you can see more things. So.
Yeah, Eric in Boise, Idaho had asked that question online here, the fish finder, and I don't know why I think of a sounder as, you know, old school, you know, weight on a rope, and I'm not sure if that was the term they used to use when boats were coming into port, you know.
But I know guys, you know, the marked anchor rope I talked about, other people would use a weight on a line as well to plumb the depths, if you will, to find out what they're sitting in, because in still waters you've got to know how deep you're sitting in. It governs your sink, you know, no matter what you're doing, it governs how long you let things sink, what lines you choose, all of those kind of things. It's really feel like you're fishing blind if you don't know how deep you're sitting in.
Yeah, another question from Matt in Kamloops, up in your neck of the woods. he says, I understand a lot of the techniques and have used them with some levels of success. I struggle with finding the area to fish and finding the depth. We talked about the depth. So how do you go about finding the water you want to fish and set up in?
Well, I always like to start shallow, if I can at all, because as fly fishers, that's when we have... You know, we can, you know, not just with chironomids, but everything in general, we have all of our presentation tools at our option, different sinking, different line choices, indicators, non-indicators, you know, intermediate lines, fast sinking lines, a whole host of things. So I start there. I like to look for structure. I nickname it my field of dreams theory. If you find it, they will come. So I like weed beds. obviously I like to target those areas. Drop-offs, trout-like, as a source of protection, deep water nearby, so if they get startled, they can go into deep water. When we're chironomid fishing, muddy flats are prime chironomid habitat. So if there's hatches on, fish are going to be attracted to those areas. It's like a feeding line in a river. So long as there's food, there'll be fish there. So you work those areas. And, of course, you're always using your powers of observation. You're looking on the water for signs of the hatch. When you're on waters where chironomids are actively emerging or have emerged, you'll see the shucks on the water. You'll see adults, you know, flying off. Those kind of things. So, and you move around. You move every 15 to maybe 30 minutes or so and move around till you find them. And you're always, the one thing to do is look for fish. Thankfully, in lakes, a lot of the species, brown trout, rainbows, cutthroat, those kind of things, they can be quite a showy fish, meaning they'll announce their presence. They'll swirl at the surface. That doesn't mean necessarily they're taking dry flies, or they'll jump out of the water, perhaps to rid themselves of parasites or things like this. I call those itchy fish. Fish that leap 3 and 4 feet out of the water aren't feeding fish, but that tells you there's fish in the neighborhood and you want to go over there and investigate, because where there's one, there's others. And if they're active and moving around like that, there's a pretty good chance they'll take a fly.
This technique we've just been talking about, deep water indicator fishing, and the others that we're going to talk about next, can you do any of these from the shore?
I mean, oh, of course.
Effective with them?
Yeah, yep, obviously. Last spring, we were out in Manitoba, and one of the lakes we like to fish, but we almost had what we call a weather day. The wind was coming out of the north at close to, in Canadian kilometers, is 80 kilometers, so that's like 50 miles an hour. It was just blowing, and we were able to tuck ourselves right up against the, you know, where the wind was coming from, and the fish were quite happily cruising along in there, and we were just simply using roll cast and suspending our flies 4 to 6 feet down, depending on where you were on the shoreline, and taking fish as they were cruising right along the shore. So, yeah, you can use these methods from the shoreline, from a boat, whenever. Yes, they will work.
Okay. Eric in Boise again. Eric's quite prolific with his questions. Thanks, Eric.
I think I know which Eric it is.
Oh, okay. Can you explain why you have different color indicators, orange, yellow, red, and green? Is it necessary to have each one?
Oh, yes, you've got to have them all. No, actually, all sizes, all colors, tons of them on hand. No, unfortunately, there is no silver bullet when it comes to indicators. You know, I use my quick-release indicators a lot, but I also use yarn, you know, dry dropper situations. You know, there's different light conditions. I try to use the smallest indicator I can for two reasons. I find them more sensitive, and when we're indicator fishing, whether we're fishing with a traditional, you know, leader setup, you know, nylon or fluorocarbon leader setup, or the, you know, that deep water technique I talked about that discovered in California, you want to keep your cast close. You want to be able to react quickly if you see the strike, because unfortunately not all indicator strikes are your classic tug beneath the surface 1 foot and leaves a bubble trail. Some of them can be very, very subtle. It can be just kind of a wallowing, or it just dips, or just move sideways. It's like nymphing on a river. You want to keep things close so you can react to them. But sometimes the wind's up, or you've got, you know, a heavy selection of flies on. You know, we often fish sometimes when we're exploring. We might have a balanced leech on the bottom and a chironomid pupa, you know, 18 to 24 inches up above. And so we're exploring the water with different flies at different depths. So, you know, you might want to use a bigger indicator in that situation. Some people just see colors differently. I find the fluorescent colors work best when you have bright light or the light from behind. That indicator stands out very well. But if you're fishing into the glare of a sun, it's quite hard sometimes to see those bright colors. And, you know, if you look at river fishing where you use fishing a dry fly into the glare of a sun, a white winged fly is tough to see, but you put a black winged fly in there, you can see it because of the silhouette factor. A number of years ago, I fished Pyramid Lake in Nevada for the big Lahontans that are in there. And, of course, back to that previous question, we were indicator fishing from shore with chironomids there as well and leeches and other things. Got to stand on ladders. It's a unique fishery. But the water coloration there is a very pale, almost whitish green, and traditional high-vis color indicators are actually a little challenging to see, and the locals down there take the indicators and they spray paint them black so that they can see them. So that's a trick I learned, and you know, it's the good thing about getting to fish and getting out there and seeing how others do it is you can. This is where you learn these things from. So unfortunately, there's not one indicator color. I probably use the bright fluorescent colors, your hot pinks, your hot oranges, your sunburst oranges, most often. But I have green ones. I have a few black ones. I paint up different colors for different situations. You're always kind of experimenting, but probably I'd use a half inch diameter hot orange indicator most often.
Okay. All right. Let's take a quick break. This sounds like a good place to take a break. And when we come back, we'll move on to the second, dry line long leader techniques. So we'll be right back. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department, and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Phil Rowley about advanced chronomid techniques. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your questions. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight. Okay, Phil. I think we're ready to move on to the second one?
Sure.
Okay. What is the dry line long leader technique?
That is, and in some circles we refer it to the naked technique, because it is a floating line with a long leader and no indicator. Well, no indicator in the sense of the word that everybody use indicators nowadays. In reality, your fly line becomes the indicator. So what we're doing there, and this was the method I first learned to fish chironomids with, because indicators weren't around then. So it is the traditional method. It's fishing leaders 15, 18, 22, 25. I know even some people use up to 30 or 35 foot leaders. So to some, it's quite intimidating, that leader length. We're playing really with this method with four variables. We're playing with the leader length, the speed of your retrieve, the pattern weight, and the actual how long you let the fly sink. And of those two, people struggle most often with letting the fly sink. And this is common to me in all stillwater situations. People don't let their flies sink long enough, and they don't move them slow enough. And we're talking about when we're fishing for trout in lakes, not other species like pike, where I don't think you can move a fly fast enough at times. But so we want to keep that, because in essence, this method works the same as an indicator, which suspends the fly at a set depth. By balancing these four variables, you are tracking the fly through that same depth zone. Okay? But if you go too fast with your retrieve, you'll start to climb up through the water column and kind of the zone. Consequently, if you let it sink too long, it will hit the bottom. And like every method, these have their places. I tend to use strike indicator, the traditional strike indicator methods, in water, not the deep water technique, but just sort of the standard strike indicator methods that are in use today. Let's say water 12 feet or less. I use the naked technique probably 15 feet or greater, and like a camera lens, it has a sweet spot. So for me, in that 15 to 18 foot range, this method to me has really performed, and it's the take is very addictive. It's very similar to the wet fly swing, where you get that just that little pluck or dart or the line tightening that you have a fish on, or you actually see the visual cues of the fly line starting to straighten out before you actually feel the strike. So let's look at those four variables. Pattern weight's pretty straightforward. We either use, in really deep water situations, tungsten-based patterns, but a lot of times I'm just using standard brass bead heads. You know, a chironomid larva, a pupa pattern, is a very thin pattern. They cut through the water quickly, more quickly than obviously a bushy pattern, like, say, a woolly worm or a woolly bugger or something like that. So they're going to sink quickly, because sometimes too much tungsten it just sinks too fast, and it's throwing the whole thing out of whack. Wind comes into this. If there's a lot of wind movement that's pushing water and moving water, that's going to create current like in a river, and that's going to inhibit the sink rate of your fly. The leader length, we use a formula or a leader that's based upon 25% longer than the depth of the water you're fishing, and that's because of the way we construct, or I construct, the leaders. And I begin by taking, I use Rio's indicator leaders. These are a 10-foot leader intended for nymphing on rivers. So the difference between an indicator leader and your standard trout leader, which is more tailored to your standard dry fly presentation where the butt section of the leader is approximately 50% of the overall leader length to get that nice delicate turnover, these indicator leaders have a short butt section of about 2 feet, and then it quickly transitions into level line that sinks quickly. So what I do is I essentially take that 10-foot indicator leader and I extend the butt section and extend the tippet section to make my overall length. So I'll start with approximately 3 feet of about 25 thou diameter butt material that I'll clinch knot to the welded loop of my fly line. And all the Rio indicators are 22 thou in diameter, so you want a butt section that is equal or preferably slightly thicker than the butt diameter of the indicator leader. I'll attach the butt section to the indicator leader using a blood knot, and then on the other end, either a swivel, a clinch knot in, or I'll use a triple surgeon's knot to complete the overall length of the leader. And I ebb and flow the leader length on the tippet side of the leader. And this leader I nickname a hybrid leader because you can also indicator fish with it by simply adding or removing the indicator, and I keep that on the butt section of the indicator leader, which kind of has an orange coloration to it. It really doesn't have any bearing in still water use, but that's where I put my indicators. And again, if I need to cut that leader back, I'll cut it back on the tippet or leader end, and the butt section stays intact. So what this gives you is a stiff butt section to help turn over long leaders, get that nice turnover that you're looking for, and get everything laying out nicely, and yet you still have a thin diameter leader and tippet section that sinks through the water quickly and gets the fly down. And the reason we have the 25% length is because the leader kind of sinks in a bit of an arc, so it doesn't sink straight off the end of the fly line, so therefore you need a little bit of extra length to compensate for that arc, so you know the fly will get down there. And then the retrieve speed is dead slow. Slow hand twist or retrieve I call a pinch strip, where you literally take your retrieve hand and touch it to your rod hand and just pinch using your thumb and forefinger short little 1-inch lengths of line in. And you're doing this so slow. If the water is relatively calm, the fly line must not, no wake whatsoever from the line. If you're making any kind of disturbance on the surface, you're moving your fly line too fast. So when I was taught years and years ago, it was when you think you've got the retrieve right, you cut it in half again. So this is a method you're not going to die of exhaustion with. Well, you might, because you can catch a lot of fish, so you're fighting them all the time. And sink times, I'm letting my fly sink a minimum of 30 seconds, and I use my watch to keep myself honest. I'll literally make a cast. I'll use that same wind drift technique I talked about where I'll quarter it, let it swing, and then count it down, my 30 seconds, and I start there. And it's just like the countdown method with a sinking line. You're experimenting until you start touching fish.
Okay. We got, if we have any questions regarding that method out there.
Everybody's probably completely confused.
Yeah, here's one. What the hell are you talking about?
Join me on one of my seminars. I'll show you firsthand.
Okay. I guess Eric's asking about this technique. He wants to know how many flies you'd have on a 15, 20-foot leader. Are you,
well,
one or are you tandem? You're only allowed one up there, aren't you?
I'm allowed, British Columbia, you're only allowed one. I've now moved to the other side of the Rockies. I'm in Alberta where we can fish up to three. And I'll tell you, since I started getting introduced to droppers, they are, to me, droppers are the last thing you want to do is catch two fish. That just, you know, it's happened. I'm not going to, but usually it's adios. One fly goes one way, one goes the other. It's all over. But droppers add so many variables. First of all, obviously you can fish multiple sizes. You know, different sizes, different colors, totally different patterns. Because the flies in this naked system track at different depths, you can gauge where the fish are in the water column by which fly is getting the attention. So if your middle fly is always getting the grabs, that tells you the fish are probably higher in the water column. And you can carry on doing what you're doing or perhaps change to a different presentation, such as a strike indicator, and really target that zone where the takes seem to be coming. You know, if it's windy, people talk, you know, they put maybe a split shot on their line or integrate a swivel in there. Adding another fly is another source of weight. then of course it's also a chance for something to come along and bite it as well. So the droppers offer so many tactical advantages. And I typically use two, but I have on occasion put three on the line, you know, to track different things, especially early in the presentation where I'm not necessarily sure where in the water column the fish are, or maybe it's particularly breezy and I want to get the flies down. And we also use another line we use floating lines primarily for this, but another excellent line to use is a midge tip. And that's a floating line with about 36 inches of really clear intermediate line. You know, years ago we used to use, you know, either loop to loop or actually splice a little tip of a type 2 sinking line or a type 1 into the end of the fly line to help kick and get that down in deeper water. So I was fishing in British Columbia earlier this year, single fly, of course, and we were into 21, 22 feet of water. So I was using a midge tip to help get that long leader down as well, because the fish were right off the bottom to be successful, because it just wasn't, you're starting to get to using, you know, really deep water indicating, starting to get to the end of the practical use of that. The naked technique was a better presentation choice for that scenario. So,
okay. Just got a message from Paul out there. Paul is having connectivity issues. Can't really help you with that. I don't know if anybody else is in the internet feed, but yeah, Paul, you can pick up the recording later on, and or folks, you can always switch to the phone. You can call in using the phone line. The phone number should be listed in that window as well, so you have that as an alternative if you're having problems out there. Okay, question came in, Phil. Sarah in Cedar Falls, you let it sink for a full 30 seconds. Isn't that a little too long to let it go? Doesn't 15 work better?
30 seconds, and again, I talk about the sweet spot of this presentation, which has been typically, when I'm fishing that 16 to 18 foot range I was talking about, my leader is typically about 22 feet long in total length from the end of the fly line to the very end of the tippet. I've got two flies on. When I'm not using an indicator, I like my flies about 3 to 5 feet apart because they don't present vertically like under an indicator. They're on a bit of an angle, so they're tracking slowly back horizontally almost through the water column at, you know, probably maybe 2 feet apart. You know, I haven't dove down and actually peaked, but tracking at those different levels. And that 30 seconds has worked well. You know, we're talking flies 10s, 12s, 14s, you know, small bead heads. So they sink, but they don't plummet, and they do get down. One of my favorite places to try this method is if you're fishing off a sloping drop-off or a ridge that's running, you know, across a lake, and the trout will cruise along the face of that ridge or over a drop-off, and you can work those flies, you know, right the way along at the end of the retrieve up the face a little bit and have a chance to intercept the fish where they're coming through. It really works well. There are sometimes it may be only 15 or 20 seconds. You're experimenting, but 30 seconds, and again, with this method, using it in that sweet spot I like to use it in, that's over experience has proved to work very well for me. Of course, if you hang up, you reduce it next time or put a less heavy fly on. It's just like nymphing on a river. You're
constantly
playing around
testing and experimenting.
Yeah, always playing around until you figure it out.
Yeah. By the way, Eric says he can hear us fine in Boise, so Paul, it's probably a connectivity issue in your local area with your system. So anyway, okay, let's move on then to our third method, which is how do you use sinking lines and what is dangling?
Another great term, eh? Naked, dangling. We use sinking, you know, again, most people, again, we refer back that most people, when you talk about chronometer fishing today, think instantly of a floating line and an indicator. And we also use slow sinking lines. My two favorite are probably the hover line, which sinks at about 1 inch per second. It's a very slow sink rate, and a clear intermediate that sinks anywhere from 1.5 to 2 inches per second. So they're still a slow sinking line. The beauty of these two lines is if the wind is really up, but the fish are still on chironomids, you know, casting 20 plus feet of leader in a breeze can be, you know, challenging at times. And, of course, same with an indicator with all of that, or the actual wave action on the surface just, you know, disturbs the presentation because the line's being pulled and bounced all over the place. So what these two slower sinking lines do is just slice through that surface chop and allow you to stay in contact with the fly. And, of course, they also offer you the option of using shorter leaders. And when I like to use these as well is you've got fish that will eat a chironomid, but there may not be a strong hatch on, or anything like that. So the fish could be scattered throughout the water column. They're not concentrated in a band right above the bottom, which often happens when there's a strong, intense hatch on. They'll get zoned in. But they could be scattered out, you know, and you're just sort of probing the water with that. So you make a long cast, and you do the countdown method like you do with a leech or anything else, and just start that slow hand twist retrieve back in and cover water that way. Now, dangling is where we actually fish vertically using a fast sinking line. You can do it with any sinking line, but we tend to use fast sinking lines in the type 5, 6, or 7 range. You know, these are lines that sink at 5 to 7 inches per second. They really get down. I like the new no-stretch or in-touch lines that are out there nowadays, so you get straight connections. And we are, again, we're double anchored. We know the depth of the water we're in. This is a method I was taught to traditionally use in water 20 feet deep or less, but in some of the, you know, the waters we fish that have, you know, algae blooms and things like this that concentrate in the upper part of the water, you can fish this method in 15 feet of water. And some guys have done it in 10 feet because the fish, you know, once you anchor in and settle down and you're not noisy and stomping around, they soon accept you into their environment. You'd be amazed at the numbers and size of fish that cruise right underneath your boat. So let's say we're anchored in 19 feet again, just to pick an analogy. You want to cast out exactly probably about 18 feet of leader and line only. So we're using short leaders here. We're using, you know, typically I'm just using, well, maybe 4 feet or 5 feet if I'm using two flies of probably 4 feet of, well, let's say 3 feet of 2X fluorocarbon leader material, and then maybe 4X because I've got a little, I call it a fusible link, a bit of a break-off point in my leader setup to fish two flies. So very short leaders. And so what we do, that weight I talked about when we're setting up our indicator way back in the beginning of the program, we actually attach a weight to the point fly, the fly furthest from the end, or in a single fly setup, just attach it to your fly, and lower it over the side of the boat. And that's going to hit the bottom. Pull your line down and hit the bottom. And then what you do is you reel up the line until you feel that weight on the rod. Your rod tip will start to dip down. In some situations, with a pair of hemostats, you almost think you've caught a fish. And now the hemostats are just coming off the bottom. The rod is sensing that weight. And most of your reels are in that 3 to 4 inch diameter. I'll take 3 or 4 turns of the reel to bring it up approximately a foot, and then I'll stop. I reel in the excess line, and then I strip the remaining line in, take the weight off, and you literally put that cast out there, allow that line to sink straight down, and suspend there. So that fly is now just dangling straight down underneath, and we'll let it sit there a bit, or you'll start a very, very slow hand twist retrieve to suggest a chironomid pupa that's emerging. So it's a slow hand twist with rests. And the beauty of this method, this is a method you do not want to leave your rod lying down. You don't want to put your rod down and go grab a sandwich or fidget with something else, because the takes to this method most of the times are just scary. They really pulverize the fly. It's so exciting. You can fish in a group. You know, you can all face into each other. You're not affected by the wind because you're making such a short cast. If you've got the wind in your face, you can roll cast or flop something out. You let it sink down and wait until you get the take. And the takes are just incredible. It's really addictive. We were doing it out in Manitoba this past spring, and I had a good friend with me, and 27.5-inch rainbow, 15-inch girth came to this method right underneath the boat. And this is where your electronics come in, because the challenge with this method is, I talked about that circle that moves. Well, this is a method that, unfortunately, the circle doesn't move, so the fish have to come to you. And we tend to do this most often on flat. This method works best in the 15 to 20, 25 foot. I've done it to 30 feet, 35 feet in some instances, on a big muddy flat. And there's not much weed growth down there, but again, those muddy flats are prime chironomid habitat, large concentrations in there. So this is kind of like a giant feeding lie. So if you've had hatch activity, fish are going to be conditioned for a while to come in there and graze and feed. So we're targeting these flats, often adjacent to a shoal. It's as though the fish go onto the shoal, maybe have a little of a feed, move off, and then they'll settle down in that flat right adjacent to it. We'll anchor up there. And with our sounders these days, electronics, we can see the fish literally. We will, you know, with an electric motor or oars, we'll just cruise over an area until we mark fish, and then we'll anchor up and give them a try and see if they want to play with us. And this method works, like I say, it's very exciting. It's a little challenging if you get a good fish because you've got two anchor ropes down there, so you learn some special skills on how to navigate fish in and around anchor ropes. And we use long rods. That's one of the benefits of a long rod, 9.5 foot, 10 foot. I use a lot of Mystic rods now that are 10 foot, 3 inches long. And what these rods allow you to do is when you get a fish is you can use that rod length plus the extension of your arm to steer fish around your anchor ropes and keep them out of there. You know, sometimes I have people in my boat, when a fish runs sort of diagonally towards the bow anchor, their instinctive reaction is to pull the opposite way. And what I say, it's almost like a skid in a car. You want to lean into it. You want to keep tension on that fish. But if that fish starts to pull around the bow, you turn and go with it and just follow him right around the boat. And if you keep that rod tip out there, he'll miss the anchor rope completely. But if you pull on there, you're going to pull him diagonally in. And then, yes, you can get into some challenges with fly lines and flies wrapping around anchors and lose a fish of dreams.
Great, great. Sounds like a great technique. Okay, let's do a quick break here, and then we'll come back and we'll start rolling through the questions that our audience has sent in. So hold on for just a few seconds, and we'll be right back. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Phil Rowley about advanced chronomet techniques. If you'd like to ask Phil a question, just go to our homepage and use the Q&A text box and send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Phil, got a bunch of questions. Well, let me see here. We may have some follow-ups here.
More what the heck is he talking about?
Yeah. This Eric guy, he's pestering me here, so. He says, when using faster sinking lines, they seem to twist up slash tangle more often. Do you have any suggestions on how to avoid these problems?
Yeah, actually, I just put up my Facebook page, that those who follow you on there. Zach Dalton put a great tip up today about how to take fly line twist out of your line if they're getting really twisted up. But with sinking lines, yeah, they can be prone to tangles because they are thin. Again, with this dangling method, you're using a very, you know, when you set this up to fish 19 feet down, 19 feet when you cast out looks like you threw it 6 feet. You've got to really resist the temptation to strip off more line because you don't think you're deep enough. But if in sinking lines in general, if you're, you know, traditional cast and retrieve with a leech pattern or dragonfly nymph, I actually use either a stripping apron, or I've got a bucket in my boat, much like the saltwater fly anglers use, and I put a little skim of water in there, maybe half inch or so, not even that, and you strip your line into this bucket, and the combination of the bucket and the water tends to keep the fly line apart and untangled, so it'll shoot out, and it really works well. If you're in a pontoon boat or a belly boat, you can take a hand towel and wet it and lay it on there, and just that moist towel can help keep the tangles, you know, from occurring.
Okay, let's talk about flies, because we had a bunch of questions about flies. Starting off with Don in Montana, do you have preferred patterns for lakes versus streams?
I assume we're talking about midge chronomid patterns.
Right.
Here. No, about the only difference, I take a lot of my chronomid patterns and use them in rivers. You know, I also tie some of the more famous river patterns that you hear about, mercury midges, zebra midges, those kind of things. I'll use those too. But the only thing that's different is midges is, you know, the term often used to refer to chronomids in rivers. Again, they're the same bug, is size. So you just downsize the flies, you know. And chronomids, we're probably using 8 to 6s, depending on where you are. The more northerly latitudes we get, we tend to get some bigger chronomids. And, of course, then you get bigger species in different lakes. I find when I go down to California, example, and fish down there, 14 is, you know, on average, an average size down there. 16s and 18s are common. You know, up in Canada, where I am right now, we're fishing probably a 12 standard hook is an average size, or 10s or 14s. So it does vary. But on rivers, I just use the same patterns, but just make them smaller.
Yeah, go down to San Juan and you're fishing with size 22 midges. Or something.
Yeah, you put three of them on a dime.
Yeah. Don also asked, he says, crownets seem to be tied in very different sizes. That's what you just spoke to. And for lakes, natural bend hooks are often used, but scut hooks are also used. In streams, midges are usually tied with short hooks in smaller sizes. Do the bugs differ greatly depending on the body of water they inhabit? We're just talking about the actual size of the midges.
Yeah, they can. The analogies I use, these are just generalities over my years of fishing lakes, and you know, you can't beat local knowledge or what you see firsthand on the lake. But I have found that in clear lakes, the chronomids tend to be smaller, so 12s, 14s, 16s, 18s. In your algae-type lakes that have rich, muddy bottoms, these often have dense weed growth. These are home to some very large chronomid species. You know, the ones I talked about right at the beginning of the show where you're using size 6 scud hooks, you know, the pupa are 5/8 of an inch long or sometimes even greater. So there are variations. So, again, when you get to a local lake, you know, if you can see naturals flying around, if you can catch one or it lands on you, they usually do, you can have a look. You can look at the pupal shucks on the surface. And spider webs are another great source of information. They collect all kinds of good flying things, and you can see what size patterns have been, size and colors have been coming off, and use that to start your exploratory journey as to what they're on.
Okay. R.A. initials wrote in and says, how much weight, if any, do you use on the line? Or are you weighting the fly at the vise?
I do both. There are times I will tie flies with, you know, different weighting configurations, a glass bead versus a tungsten bead or no weight at all. But for the most part, most of my chronomid patterns, I'm using brass beads of varying colors, black nickel, copper, gold, sometimes silver. There's lots of, you know, some of the bead manufacturers out today have all kinds of neat colors. I use some fluorescents as well in deeper water situations. You know, so I'm always using those. And at times I will have weight on the line. I was out a couple days ago, and it was a little breezy. And, you know, I felt that in addition to the weight of the chronomid pattern, a little external weight on the leader would help. And years ago, most people would use, you know, split shot of some kind. But the drawback to split shot is it tends to fly off the leader, or I tended to drop more split shot, it seemed, than actually put on, trying to get them out of the little containers. But we use a lot of swivels. And swivels, I'm talking small barrel swivels. They're sized like hooks. The bigger the number, the smaller the swivel. And sizes 12s, 14s, 16s. And these are not always easy size swivels to find. You have to go, if you go into a local tackle shop, you have to look around a little bit. And if you see them, grab them. And I tend to use those in black, nickel, silver, and gold. And swivels not only add weight, they reduce any line twist. If there's a bit of a chop on the water, again, they'll help sink the pattern, but they'll also dampen the bounce that the indicator might be putting in. And believe it or not, they act like a little shock absorber. If you're having incompatibility issues, you're struggling tying nylon and fluorocarbon together, which some people do, having a swivel in there, it's a little connection between the two they never touch. So I use a clinch knot or improved clinch knot to attach the swivel into the system. And swivels can also help you predict pattern, color, and depth, because it's not unheard of to be sitting out there, particularly with a strike indicator situation, and the indicator pulls under, and you set the hook, and there's nothing there. And quite often that means the fish has probably coming up and seen the swivel and tried to eat it. And that can tell you they might be attracted to the color of the swivel. If it's a black swivel, maybe you want to think about a black chronomid if you don't have one on. If they're attracted to the silver swivel, chronomids use trapped gases to aid their pupal ascent to the surface, provide, you know, internal buoyancy. That also helps them escape their pupal shuck when they transform into the adults. And those trapped gases really give the chronomids a strong predominant shine when the hatch is strong, and fish can key into that flash that triggers and tells them there's food out there. So if you're getting that constant take, that should probably tell you you can change your pattern, color, and size to match roughly what the swivel is. Or more often, I tend to move the flies up in the water column to where I believe that swivel was suspending and see if it's just a depth issue, because depth is often the most important key as opposed to color or pattern size. Depth is the key. You got to put your fly in where the fish are first.
Where do you, where in your terminal tackle setup there do you put the swivel?
The swivel, if I'm using a strike indicator, it's probably, like split shot, 16 to 18 inches above the fly.
You're tying it in line?
inline. So I would have, if we go back to that leader I described for the naked technique where I'm extending that Rio indicator leader, I've got the 3 foot buck section, blood knotted to the Rio indicator leader, and then I'm adding tippet to the end of that. Depending on the depth I'm using that in, I could, instead of using a triple surgeon's knot to connect the leader to the fluorocarbon tippet, my swivel could go there. I could consequently add a length of fluorocarbon tippet, and I still need to add some more length, and then I put the swivel in and then finish off the balance of the leader. So it's tied right into the leader itself.
Okay, good.
And the beauty compared to a split shot as well, once you're tied in, it's never going to fly off like a split shot tends to do.
Okay, we have, let's see here, Randy in Phoenix and also Eric in Boise both asked about colors of flies in different depths, different times of year, and different weather or clarity conditions. So basically, are you matching up colors of midges to these different conditions? And if so, what...
It does have an effect. In all of my still water patterns and fly patterns, you know, I look at three variables: size, shape or profile, color, and behavior. And size and the profile, obviously you want to have something that's, well, we'll talk about all of these things because there's exceptions to everything. Color can be important and isn't important, but a lot of times I'll consider the other factors first. Make sure I have a fly that's the right profile. Earlier on I talked about Crowley Lake. That was a lake I soon discovered that if your pattern was a little on the obese side, you didn't have nearly the interest of the fish that a very slender, skinny fly did. You know, the naturals that were coming off were about a size 18, but we discovered that we could use a size 14 fly or even a 12. Again, that size of the fly is going to stand out in that crowd. You know, I tease some of my friends sometimes that are trying to tie exact duplicates of flies that, well, first of all, if you put a natural beside your fly, I can see the two totally different things, but thankfully the fish don't. But you're not trying to hide your flyer amongst 80,000 natural insects. You're trying to make yours stand out in the crowd so it'll get eaten. So we often play what we call the greed card, where we use a larger fly to stand out in the crowd. Sometimes you got to match the size bang on in really selective conditions. Colors. Black is by far the most common coronamid color species you'll see. And so a black and red coronamid pupa is probably my starting point. I start there and experiment from there. It's just proven to be successful over the years. The red represents residual hemoglobin that often gathers along the abdominal segments of the coronamid pupa and sometimes in the very tip of the abdomen in the butt section. The red butt coronamids are popular. So we start there. Of course, we do use throat pumps a fair bit to sample a few fish along the day to stay in touch with the sizes and the colors, because different species can emerge for a little while and they wane and a new size and color comes on board and the fish will switch over. So it's a way of trying to stay in touch with them. And with the throat pump, you're sampling right out of the esophagus. You're not, you know, Brian and I call them throat pumps, but they're, you know, they're marketed as stomach pumps, but they're not. We're just sampling right out of the throat, and a lot of times most of the time you're getting live food sources, and you put them in a vial and look at them, you can see the lifelike qualities a living organism has over a dead organism. Other factors that come in, I use, some of the fluorescence in the UV materials I'll blend into flies, particularly when I'm fishing deeper water. I find with deeper water fishing, you can, you know, hot orange beads have worked well for me, orange wing pads, things that stand out at depth. And you can get away with a little bigger fly a lot of times as well. It's almost like when they get into the shallows, they seem to get a little more selective, and I don't have a rational reason for that. It just seems something I've seen. And we also use flies that are quite realistic at times. Some of the listeners may have heard about English-style epoxy buzzers. These are flies that don't have beads on them. They're very thin, realistic-looking flies that have little wing pads on them. They're a blast to tie. I use those as well. I've got a variation of a tie called the Clearwater Pupa that uses these. So that's a fly I would use in a situation very clear water where fish can be very selective, or waters that really see a lot of angler pressure. And they sort of get to know that those shiny beadhead flies sting a little bit, and they'll avoid them. So
okay.
Good.
Anything more there?
The only other thing I was going to add is, you know, a lot of the ice cream cone styles that BC fly fisher Kelly Davison created many years ago. I think the entire fly fishing community is indebted to Kelly for that. The white beads have become very, very popular, and they really do work in most situations. But there are times fish, the white beads is a bit too overt and stark, so it's common for me to have the same pattern with a white bead and with maybe a black bead and traditional sort of yarn gills sticking out in front of the bead to both situations. I know of other fly anglers that I know take a black Sharpie with them and will actually color most or partially color the white bead to sort of knock the stark white down. Because the white beads do work well at depth and also work well in algae-stained waters because they stick out and they don't get all fouled up with the algae and turn green like, you know, regular materials like an ostrich hurl or a yarn do. So the white beads are very popular too.
Okay, we've got a bunch of questions left, so we're going to have to move fast here.
Okay.
Trying to get everybody satisfied. David, Dallas, Texas, want to know, he said it's been suggested to him that hookups are improved with small, narrow gap hooks by bending the hook to the side. Is this your experience or something you do?
You can use the offset hooks. I do use them from time to time. To be honest, I haven't really noticed much of a difference. Maybe that's a project for me this spring and summer of 2014. The drawback with small hooks and big fish is they can still straighten because it's just such a light, small hook. That's sort of the challenge of it all. So one of the tricks we do is we tie a small pupa on a larger hook. So let's say the coronamids are a size 18 coming off. We might tie a size 18 pupa on a size 12 hook, almost low water style, where the actual whole length of the fly may only occupy half the hook. Yes, there's that big hook bend sticking down, but thankfully fish don't seem to correlate that that hook's a bad thing, or we wouldn't be catching anything with any fly, I don't think. So that's one of the ways around that. So I haven't, and my colleagues, I don't ever remember us having offsets, but one thing they will turn in and hook a little easier and better. So I would say certainly I would recommend trying them. It certainly can't hurt.
Scott, Portland, Oregon, wrote in and he says, does lock-style stillwater fly fishing like used in Scotland and the UK have a place in North American fly fishing? Just how effective is it compared to some of your or other North American methods for still waters? And then he adds, could you use your fly fishing techniques to clean up at Loch Leven?
I want to go to Loch Leven, so hopefully I can give a better answer to that in a few years. Yes, North Loch style techniques definitely have a place. They're another method to learn and to become consistent with. When I'm fishing coronamids, I tend to like to anchor up and get total presentation control because of the subtle takes and the total line control you need with your retrieves. If you're Loch style fishing, the boat's moving. For those not familiar, you are fishing out of a drifting boat with a drogue or a sea anchor. It's probably referred to most often in North America, but a drogue that slows and controls your drift. And you're still casting and retrieving. And the benefit of this is obviously you can cover water, and you're always presenting your flies to fresh fish. There is a point sometimes when you're anchored up and you sort of beating the death out of every fish in the area, and they'll move off, they'll sense your presence, and you'll have to move to go engage them some more. But the beauty of lock-style fishing is you're covering an area. So sometimes I'll use both methods. I'll lock-style for a while, and you consistently hit fish in the same spot. I might return back and sort of anchor up on there and see if there's some reason they're hanging around there and have some fun with them that way. So there's definitely, it's again, like everything, learn as many different methods as you can. Don't get dialed into one particular method. Be versatile.
So hopefully, Charlie and Dutch John, hopefully that answers your question there, because he had written about lock style and a drogue or just sock. So good.
That's a technique unto itself. That's another interview.
Yeah. Talked about this. Rod in Portland is asking about color and how far off the bottom. I think we addressed all of that. Okay. Rod in Portland writes in and somewhat addressed this in the beginning, but he says, Phil, how long do you sit there and wait for a take before you cast to a new spot or fish a different depth of water column? With all due respect, how do you fight the boredom of coronamid fishing?
I'm not going to lie. Some days when the fishing's slow in general, it can be boring, so you do things to keep yourself focused and engaged. So typically...
And drinking beer in the boat is against the law up in Canada, right?
Okay. No comment. You try to stay engaged, change flies, play with your retrieves, play with your depths, do things, don't do the same thing over and over again. If it's, I'll give it 15 to 30 minutes, and, I'm no different. My attention span starts to wane when things get slow. So I'll either play around with my patterns, play around with my depth, static. Maybe I'll do a hand twist retrieve. Maybe I'll wind drift. Maybe I'll start the set 6 to 12 inch pulls I talked about, and I'll pick up and move. If, you know, the analogies I use is a thing called DRP. People always, if somebody's having a great day fishing, the first question they always ask them is what fly you're using, and that certainly has an effect. But most people, again, it's depth and retrieve speed and then pattern. That's what depth, D, retrieve, R, and pattern for P. So I'm playing with depth and retrieve, and if I think I'm doing everything right, then I tend to change locations more readily than I'll change patterns, because the fish just aren't there, so you need to move around. So you're constantly watching for bird activity to indicate a hatch, other anglers catching fish, fish moving, work shallow, work deep, work different structures until you, you know, find what's working for that particular day or the trip you're on.
Okay, three
more questions.
But
that'll keep you on board.
Yeah, three more questions. We'll call it a night here. Walt and R.A. asked about weighting. I think we asked that. Dave Pitt Meadows wrote in and says, seems that certain lakes dangling a chronomid consistently works better than an indicator and vice versa. Any theories on that?
Ooh. Yeah, there's just some waters that do that. Again, I tend to use the dangling method in deeper waters, muddy flats, and if the fish are sort of conditioned to patrol those flats, and you get a much more direct contact with that dangling method because you're straight down, you're using a short length of line, often these new no-stretch lines that are out today, and a short leader. So if that fish moves away with that fly, as soon as he takes and starts to move, it transmits up to you very, very quickly. Whereas with a strike indicator, it's going to take the fly, and it has to move to trigger any kind of signature of a strike on the indicator, because you're in a 90-degree bend. Your line, your leader goes out to the indicator, and then from the indicator straight down to the fly. And I think in some situations, fish can start to grab, inhale the fly, start to move off, start to feel that something's not right, either the fly itself or the tension it's starting to feel. It knows that lunch shouldn't pull back, and spits, and you don't even see the take, or you see it, but you can't react to it quick enough because the fish has already spat the fly. So hopefully that answers some of that why.
Okay. Scott Connor in Reno, Nevada has two questions. He says, what is the spacing between your two flies when indicator fishing? And what is the spacing between your two flies when stripping without an indicator?
Beneath an indicator, probably, and it depends on the dropper method. If you're using a tandem method where you're tying off the bend of the hook, which truthfully I don't use very much anymore, I like to have my flies off their own dropper working their own water. So the length of your dropper has an effect because it hangs down, which will affect the distance the flies are working. Probably, I'd say 16 to 24 inches, depending on dropper length, if there's any, and water clarity as well, and how deep I'm fishing, what different depths I want to prospect. If I'm fishing in 8 feet of water, I'm going to keep my flies a little closer together because there's only so much water to work. But if I'm in 12 feet of water under an indicator, I might spread them out a little bit to work a little bit more water at the same time.
Okay. And then with stripping?
And when stripping, I like them 3 to 5 feet apart. The clearer the water, the greater the separation. And quite often that 5 foot range is where I like them, because you got to remember, again, with that dry line long leader, the naked technique, though you're bringing those flies back, they actually track. They're not 3 to 5 feet apart. They're probably working closer together like that, the way they track through the water column.
Okay. And I had one final question from Don Montana. He is asking about, is there a time of day when the pupa are more active or available to this fish?
I find chronomids, you know, there are some situations I talked about in Crowley where we were up on the water at 7 a.m., but most of the time your hatches are getting going 9, 9:30 in the morning when that sun gets on the water and starts to warm it a little bit, and the half a degree temperature change can be all that it needs to get going. So generally 9, 9:30, 10, that kind of early, you know, mid-morning, if you will, through until about 3 or 4 o'clock. There are always exceptions where it carries on all day long, and those are great times. But that's sort of the sweet spot, if you will, when you want to make sure you're on the water, have your lunch with you, and lots of liquids on hand so you don't have to go into shore.
Okay, great. Well, that kind of wraps it up for tonight. Covered a lot of ground, that's for sure. Stick with me here. We're going to do a few more things, and Phil, I'm going to need your help in our little contest that we have here at the end. And when we return, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and then we'll also be giving away a copy of Phil and Brian's latest DVD, Conquering Chronomids, Volume 1, Strike Indicator Techniques, as well as Phil's book, Stillwater Selections, and the DVD, Learning with the Pros. which is a companion to Stillwater Selection. So stay with us. There's some great prizes here to win, and you may be the one. So, a mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat. Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna Coal will be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna Coal strip mine. For more information about how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.org. That's inletkeeper.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes. And the winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you haven't registered for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so that you don't miss out on winning one of these great prizes we have. Now, if you are one of the lucky winners, we're going to contact you after the show to provide you with information on how to receive your gift, so we'll take care of that. Now, the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. To learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. Great organization to be part of, and they're helpful to us and also to our fisheries, so it's good to support them. And our first winner there is John Wenslick. John Wenslick in Missouri. And congratulations, John. John, let's write down your name real quick. John Wenslick in Missouri. And so you'll have that one-year membership to the Federation. If you already have a membership, let us know and we'll try to get it extended for you. Now, our second prize here is, okay, try it again. So, oh, Bob Nunn. Bob Nunn in New Jersey. I know Bob's been a long-time listener. And, Bob, you're going to get a subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. So let us know. Again, if you already have one, we'll see if we can get it extended for you. But congratulations, Bob Nunn in New Jersey. Okay, now, the big grand prize is here. Now, Phil, they have to answer a question that I ask here on the front page of our website, and they got to type it in. So this is only available to people listening to the live show. So we have really two prizes to give away, the Stillwater Selections and DVD, Learning with the Pros. We're going to make that our first prize. And our second prize is going to be the DVD, Conquering Chronomids, that you and Brian put together. So we're going to do a first in trying to conserve time here, since we're already at the end of the 90 minutes, is we're going to make it a first and second place prizes for this. Okay. So the question... And there's this is kind of a two question, three answers. Let's put it that way. When Phil was talking about fishing with sinking lines and dangling, how many turns of, now wait for the second part of this, how many turns of the reel did he say to use to get the fly off the bottom? Second part of the question is, other than split shot, what are the two different types of weights that Phil is using to get the fly down? Two different kinds of weights. So let's see if we got any winners out there, Phil. Oh, I'm checking the queue here. People are hopefully madly typing away.
Hopefully I haven't put them to sleep.
Let's see here. Okay. Matt Kamloops says swivel and lead putty. Yeah, well, one of those is right, but you missed the other part of the question about the reel turn. It's not going to work. Forceps. That's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for waiting to fly, not to find depth. Okay, here's one. Don Bishop, returns, swivels, and weighted fly.
That works.
What do you think, Phil?
That works.
That works?
Yep. Yep. Okay. 3 to 4 turns. You want to get it about a foot off the bottom and either a swivel or, beadhead fly of some sort.
Right, that's one. Then there's another one so beadhead fly. Yep, weighted fly. So, Don, hey, you are the winner of Phil's book, Stillwater Selections, and a DVD, Learning with the Pros, that goes along with it. So, and Don, I know where you live, so you don't have to send me your address. Don was started this whole show with me, 6-7 years ago. We started Ask About Fly Fishing together, so he was one of the founders of this show. So good to have him back on board, and happy he won. So that's great, Don. Congratulations. Okay, and let's see. We're looking for a second winner here, a second place. I've got 2 to 3 turns, swivels for weight and beads. And you said 3 to 4, but 2 to 3 is probably close.
That'll work too. Yeah. It's just some measure to get the fly up off the bottom. No sense of leaving it in the mud.
So, Paul, in Hesperia, you need to send me your mailing address, contact information. You can do so in the same box you just answered the question in, or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and then we'll get you out that DVD, Phil and Brian's latest DVD, Conquering Chironomids, Volume 1, Strike Indicator Techniques. And, Phil, real quick, where can the people that didn't win get your DVDs and books?
Best place to get them is on mine and Brian's online Stillwater Fly Shop. That's stillwaterflyfishingstore.com. Or if you go to either mine or Brian's websites, mine's flycraftangling.com, and just click the link down the left margin, online store. It'll take you right there. You can get books, DVDs, the quick release indicators, the jig hooks for balance flies, and a complete selection of our most favorite Stillwater patterns, including lots of focus on chironomids.
Terrific, terrific. Well, thank you. And thank you, Phil, for being on the show tonight. You were just a wealth of information. I really, truly enjoyed the conversation, and I'm sure everybody learned just a ton. So thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. It was great. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Great. Warren, our next broadcast will be on October 2nd at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we'll interview Jason Borger, and our topic for the show will be skinny water trout. Jason will guide us through skinny water for trout, one of the most challenging and frustrating fly fishing scenarios one can encounter. So be there and learn about skinny water. We would like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, Royal Gorge Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you won't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.